And so by contrast, instead of using the internet, have you ever thought of leaping back in time and spreading the message as a town crier, as they may have done in 1616? This is what Professor Peter Bernhardt has done in his review of a new book all about knowledge.
Step right up, ladies and gentlemen. Step up and witness Michael Streven's new book, The Knowledge Machine: How Irrationality Created Modern Science. It's not death-defying, but it's career-defining for a philosophy professor at New York University and an expatriate New Zealander. Why? Consider the subtitle, ladies and gents. The author insists that the scientific method is irrational, because unlike all other human constructs, it only works when you drop all philosophical, religious, and traditional preconceptions. Beauty is truth, and truth is beauty? Not in science, mate. Professor Strevens is a provocateur and something of a braggart. In 292 pages, aided by 18 pages of footnotes, he claims he can answer two big questions. First, how does science work, and why is it so effective? Second, why did real science take so long to emerge, and why did it sprout in Western Europe in the 17th century? Hey, lady, put that copy of Guns, Germs, and Steel away. It won't work here. The author does a pretty good job answering the first question, taking 8 chapters to address a number of conflicting issues. As you would expect, we are steeped in the philosophy of Karl Popper, Thomas Kuhn, and Francis Bacon. While Professor Strevens takes big examples from physics, he also shows us what happens when researchers disagree about the structures of fish, snowflakes, hormone molecules, and the coastline of continents. We need all these things to confront examples of bias in the laboratories, watch how hypotheses are built, and employ a form of empirical testing in which observation is supreme. Strevens enriches his arguments with the use of illustrations. Some are centuries old, kid, to help us see how scientists interpreted the evidence. Mind you, I think we might have lived without a still from the 1936 Hollywood version of Romeo and Juliet. A warning here. These chapters are slow-going, and it may be the author's fault. Strevens likes to strut. An older generation of Brits would say he's too clever by half. In all fairness, the author provides us with a glossary of terms and phrases he's invented, and you're going to need them, as some are too long to memorize. You may also find his use of such common words as beauty, sterile, and shallow, peculiar. On to the second question, why did it take so long for modern science to arrive? According to Professor Strevens, the reason the 17th century was the century of Galileo, Robert Boyle, Robert Hooke, and most of all, Sir Isaac Newton, was due to the 30 Years' War. Yes, I was a little underwhelmed here myself, but the author goes on to argue that while this war was fought under religious pretexts, its duration and impact changed the way people thought about themselves. In a new era of nation-states, an educated man could now divide and compartmentalize his private thoughts. It gave us the first modern scientists who could address reality in several different ways. Newton, in particular, divided up his mentality and waking hours so sometimes he was a loyal Englishman, then a physicist, then an alchemist, and finally a renegade theologian. I'm not sure I'm buying Professor Streven's solution here, but it's interesting. Upon reading this book, there were times I wondered whether the author believed that 17th century Europe made Newton, or did Newton make the 17th century? The final 3 chapters are grouped under the title Science Now. They are supposed to be about how scientific minds are trained and how science will care for us if we care for it, but they have a bitchy tone. Sorry, there's no other word for it. There are an awful lot of generalizations in these last chapters that could be refuted by scientists glibber than myself. For one thing, after 4 years of the Trump administration, I suspect that almost every scientist left in North America is aware that demagogues in politics, religion, and business are conducting a lucrative war against research results. I have no qualms about recommending this book to my audience. After all, it's not possible to agree with everything within the scope of this volume. A friend and former colleague in New South Wales once complained to me about postmodernist essays in Australian newspapers. Really? Well, you won't find them here. If postmodernists pain you, the knowledge machine may be therapeutic.
Professor Peter Bernard from St. Louis with a therapeutic volume called The Knowledge Machine by Michael Strevens, who has a considerable reputation. And before I go, someone with an equally sizable reputation as an economist. Professor Mariana Mazzucato was on the Money Programme on RN last week, and she made much of the Apollo mission to the moon as a way to tackle urgent challenges like climate and COVID. Here's a brief extract of what she said.
It would have never happened had the civil servants been risk averse. It would have never happened if they feared failure. It would have never happened if they didn't think really concretely about how NASA itself had to change. So Gus Grissom, one of the three astronauts who died after the Apollo 1 fire, just before dying, basically some hours before, he said, how are we ever going to get to the moon if we can't even talk between three buildings? Because he couldn't hear what was being said to him. And after that, they learned a lot to change their communication flows. They tried to get more dynamic, more flexible, more agile within government. But that was because they cared about getting to the moon. The problem is if we don't care about our social challenges today, we don't even ask our questions like that.
Let's talk about this, because this idea of the Apollo program offering a kind of model for change to tackle some of the really hard problems, you have identified some key characteristics that maybe we could try and get to happen elsewhere.
Yes, we need to begin with the biggest point, which is there was serious leadership, which I don't think we have enough of today. You know, Kennedy's speech was very clear that it was going to involve, you know, a huge amount of money, but he said it was worth it. He said that it was important to do because it's hard, not because it's easy. You know, who says that today, that we're going to fight climate change because it's hard? We will screw up along the way, but hey, it's okay. And then he talked about all the important things that he knew. I mean, this was actually quite insightful. The spillovers that he knew would also happen. And if you look at all the spillovers that did happen across not just aeronautics, but nutrition, materials, electronics, the whole software industry in some ways was a spillover from that, but also very concrete things like camera phones, foil blankets, wireless headset, a home insulation, baby formula, and so on. So when you really have a goal and a target, and don't think about small questions like which market failure am I going to fix? Had they thought about the economic value ex ante, they would have never even bothered going to the moon. The social goals we have today are much harder than going to the moon. It's not purely technological, so we should definitely...
Going to the moon, it's enormously challenging. It involves lots of complicated things to be solved, but it's such a simple idea. Success or failure is easy to see, and it's easy for all of us to kind of get on board with that.
First of all, there was quite a bit of pushback from people in the civil rights community, for example. They were saying, hey, you know, we have poverty on Earth and you're spending all this money in space. So we shouldn't forget that there was controversy. It wasn't as easy as it sounds. But the reason I think it worked was not because it was easy, but because NASA was very confident. So, for example, with all the businesses that got involved, because this was not state run. I mean, it was state led, but there was lots of different businesses from General Electric, Honeywell, Motorola, and so on. How they interacted with government was through not just government leadership, but confidence. So, for example, NASA had a clause in the procurement contract with these companies of no excess profits.
Mariana Mazzucato, Professor of Economics at the University College in London, on The Money Programme, RN, with Richard Adey. Worth hearing in full. And we have some space for you on the Science Show next week. Dark Matter and Dark Deeds. Production by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams. Thank you.